Let's go ahead.
Yep.
Good morning to everybody. This is a pretty large crowd, so thank you very much for your interest and going to the effort of coming down here to see what's going on in the world of the Public Information Act compliance. I was going to introduce our board first. Me is John West, the chair of this board. Darren Wigfield from Frederick.
Renee Swafford.
Eastern Shore.
Caroline County.
Larry Effingham, Eastern Maryland.
And Deborah Moore Taylor is from Baltimore City, and she'll be along, I hope, shortly, but maybe something came in the way of this. I'd like to welcome all the folks that we have here from the various jurisdictions around, and I would just wondering if can I just take a roll call here so we know exactly who's here. I have the following on this list: Rosetta Butler from Baltimore County, John Wesley from Baltimore City, Richard Wokettle from the Bowie Police Department, present, Bonita Anderson, City of Greenbelt, Kendra Randall Jolivet, Commission on Judicial Disabilities. Thank you. Amy Grasso from DHCD.
Here.
And Courtney Wright from DHCD. David Smith from Hancock. Holly Barrett, the Maryland State Police. Ida Williams, Maryland State Police. Okay. Ronald Fisher, Maryland State Police. Stacy Roig, the Maryland Workers' Compensation Commission. Karen Evans, Maryland Board of Nursing. Kimberly Schultz, Maryland Department of Education, probably. Amanda Redmiles, MDE. Mark Schaefer, MDE. Sue Battle McDonald, MDE. Adina Crawford from Montgomery County Police. Mary Davidson, Montgomery County Police. Alaya Parker, Montgomery County Police. Veronica Marmol, Montgomery County Public Schools. Joanne Causey, Montgomery County Public Schools. Okay. What's your name?
Stacy Roig.
Okay. From Maryland Workers' Compensation Commission. Thank you. And Kathy Coble, Northeast Maryland Waste Disposal Authority. We have Jeff Hochstetler over in the corner here. Janice Clark, PICB staff, both of them. Lisa Kirshner, our ombudsman. Tammy Cathell. Thank you. Michael Schlein, Secretary of State's Office. Christopher Tachik. Kasich. From UMBC, Laura Anderson Wright, University of Maryland, College Park. Renita Lewis, University of Maryland at Baltimore. And Irma Robbins, University of Maryland, Baltimore. Is there anybody here whose name was not called?
Stewart, Maryland Municipality.
Leslie Knapp, Maryland Association of Counties.
Okay. Thank you all very much. All right, I'd like to review. You all don't have a copy of the draft of the annual report and instructions for the staff for finalization, but we have the report available, and once it's finalized, it'll be distributed. But I wanted to review the draft report with our board here. And the first thing I would like to address is we have an ombudsman or ombudsperson, Lisa Kirshner, and I cannot overemphasize the importance of her role in what happens in cases that come before the PIACB, because as you probably already know, there are many, many times when there might be a valid claim or a questionable claim that might be valid, but it is not within the jurisdiction of our board, and we refer those matters to Ms. Kirshner to address, to try to get some resolution. Our main goal is to try to make this whole function of public information availability to the public, and we try to do that. Of course, that's be done in an orderly way, but we want to see if this can work, and so far we feel like it's worth working well, but there are little glitches along the way and people have questions, and we try to get them resolved through our ombudsperson. It's always good to remind everybody who is on the board and everybody who has an interest in this that the authority given to us by the legislature is very limited. We have no authority to decide a fee waiver request. We have, the reason for that is that would impact the state funds, and there's no real, the legislature hasn't allotted any money for that. And that would also increase the workload of the PIACB. And so anyway, we have no authority to decide fee waiver cases. Any case that comes before us has to be of a request of $350 or more. If somebody makes a request and the cost would be less than $350, then that would not be within our jurisdiction. Excuse me a second. Any claim that is made 90 days after the request is not going to be within our jurisdiction. It has to be a timely filed request. And if it's just if somebody gets a claim, makes a claim, and there's just an estimate, just having the estimate of what the cost is going to be is not good enough. That's not within our jurisdiction. So just so you know that we have a narrow channel that we're swimming in, and that's why you have actually, in the end, there are very few cases that actually make it all the way to our group to decide. One of the biggest problems that we see are the requests for inmate reports. This is a systemic issue, and the reason is because when a convicted person wants to get records that'll help him on his appeal or help him go to habeas corpus kind of a case, the fees are usually, the fees for what he needs to have to make his case are usually way beyond anything he could afford, which is usually he can't afford, he or she can't afford anything. So this is a issue that we've brought before the legislature to try to get some guidance, some resolution on it. But this is something that's out there that's bothersome, because it may, we've all seen cases of a dramatic outcome where somebody has been convicted, sentenced to a long term in prison when they really didn't do it. And just knowing that that possibility is there, that they, we feel that there should be some avenue where they can go to get the records they need to present their case. Dropping back just for a second, the responsibilities of our board are to review, receive, and resolve complaints that are made. And as I said, we take that very seriously. We're trying to work this, and I think we're doing pretty well. One thing on our board is that we found is that it is critical to have someone who has a background in, what would you call it, Mr. Wakefield?
Technology and how data is stored and retrieved.
Yeah, that's a real. Some people on the board have no abilities in that regard. Some of them have very little knowledge about that. We fortunately have someone who has a lot of knowledge about that, but he is going to rotate off of this committee next year. So we want to try to get the legislature to designate that there will always be somebody with that expertise on this board. We found it very useful in some cases, and decisively so. So now, let me introduce to you Lisa Kirshner, who can elaborate on her function as our ombuds person, and tell you a little bit more about what she does to facilitate what we're after here.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me here today and for the chance to speak with you. As Mr. West was reading out the names, I recognize some of them from matters that have come my way over the last couple of years, so it's always nice to get a face with a name. First of all, I want to say that I have on my left the counsel to both the board and to my office, and on my right, this is Jeff Hochstetler, Janice Clark, who serves as our admin, our master organizer, and she's responsible for basically all the communications and outreach materials we've developed. So many of you who have worked with us, either with the board or with me, know Jan as well. But there isn't anything that I'm doing that I would not be able to do without. So I feel very fortunate that way. Just to follow up on some of the big picture issues mentioned here, my bailiwick really is any dispute arising under the PIA between a requester and an agency. So I, for example, will get requests from all the matters, almost all the matters I handle are initiated by requesters. When they come to me in mediation, it's usually because the requester comes knocking on our door, either with a question or with some discontent about what has happened. And included in that mix are a number of cases that deal with fees in one way or another. Very frequently what happens is a waiver may be requested or a reduced fee may be requested, and it's either denied or it's not brought down low enough, and they get a bill instead. So I see my fair share of fee-related matters, and there are a number of approaches we take. The board, as I'm sure many of you know, has the authority to actually decide things and then to publish a decision so that The public at large will have more information going forward. I don't decide anything. And all my work is done in confidence. I can't publish it to the public. But the focus is strictly on trying to reach practical solutions. We have focused on inmate issues a lot over the last couple of years because there are many barriers to access that inmates face. And in general, communications are much more difficult. They don't have access to email, don't always have ready access to phones and things like that. Record storage and retrieval is another kind of big foundational issue, and our experience is that agencies, the more efficient and the more trained personnel are in their own record storage and retrieval systems, the better their PIA response system is going to be. There's really a very close connection between record management and the ability to respond very efficiently to requesters, either that you do or you don't have records, and whether they're public or not public, for whatever reason. One of the trends I'll just mention very briefly that might be really of some interest to you all is that over the last year we've had an increase in the number of matters that come to us directly from agencies, not in a mediation setting, but in terms of the agency reaching out to us proactively, either with some question about a particular matter or sometimes inviting us to come to a training or asking us if we have material on a certain subject that is of interest. And I think the number of these kinds of requests that are coming in directly from agencies now has gone up, I don't know, it's at least threefold from what it was over the past year and the year before that. And so I take that in part as a sign that our outreach efforts have been working, but also as a sign that as time goes on, we're getting a much stronger working relationship so that folks do feel comfortable calling us. And that's a role that I hope to continue to develop.
Okay. In addition to that, I'd like to call on Jeff Hochstetler, who is our designated representative from the Attorney General's office. Some cases can be nipped in the bud. Some cases just need a direction as to which way it's going to go before it comes to our board. And Jeff can tell you about what happens when a claim is made and what happens to the case after that.
The Attorney General's staff, Janice, and myself are the frontline reviewer of complaints that come in for the board. And one trend that I've been here since February, and the PIACB has only issued one opinion since February, and what we have seen as a trend more often are that complaints come in that are complaining about the affordability of a fee and not necessarily that it's unreasonable. And as Mr. West was mentioning, the current jurisdiction of the board is incredibly limited. It's the threshold fee charged has to be over $350, and the complainant has to say that the fee is unreasonable for any number of reasons. So out of the, I believe, 15 complaints that the board received in fiscal year 2018, there were 11 dismissed as outside of the board's jurisdiction because the complaint dealt primarily with complainant's inability to pay the fee or the denial of a fee waiver and not necessarily that the fee was unreasonable. So that's one of the biggest trends that we have seen as far as complaints coming in. And I think it's a decent starting point to discuss sort of the future of the board and possible recommendations. If there's an increase in jurisdiction, it's preferable what that might look like. Basically what the appetite is for the public.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for any questions, suggestions that we can address here or discuss anyway. Sure.
Question about history. I wanted to know background on where the $350 threshold derived from in the first place.
Can you just say your name?
Sure. My name is Laura Anderson Wright.
And who are you with, Laura?
The University of Maryland College of Arts.
Thank you. So the question is, how did we come up with $350 as the breaking point for this? Well, as far as I know, this was in the statute before we ever got here. But the statute has only been in effect since 2015, right? 2015. And whoever the wise person or unwise person in the legislature who came up with that had enough people agree to that that's the starting point. But if this was the law can change, and every year we're asked to meet with the legislature and say, give a recommendation that what the change would be. Should this be 350? Should it be 1,000? Should it be no amount? And they've settled on that, so that's what we're working with. I have no idea who you can blame at the legislature that came up with that figure. But they pulled it out of the air. But it was probably some, you know, at least a educated guess that this would be a good. Yes, sir.
I can actually, as being one of the people that was part of that discussion, I could provide a very short background on that.
Sure.
Less than that, with the Maryland Association of Counties, that $350 came out of a stakeholders group that kind of formed around this as that legislation was moving forward to create the board. County governments, municipal governments, state agencies, open government groups, transparency groups. There was this kind of informal stakeholders group that got together. And when it came to setting that threshold, the 350 number derived from what was really looking over agency records requests, where was the threshold tipping point where, in their experience, setting a fee became a challenge or a problem where they didn't get significant pushback. And ultimately, and there was some back and forth, but $350 was found to be, that's a fairly significant records request where the amount of fees came into conflict and dispute more so than on some of the smaller amounts. So that's why that threshold was set. They didn't want to flood the board with very small cases that would end up being of more minor importance. But they did want to acknowledge where you have a big request, and particularly going into the thousands of dollars, certainly having the board review was fair.
Okay. Any other questions or thoughts on your minds that we could address here? Yes, ma'am. I'm not sure I got the whole gist of what you're. What can we do to help these folks get the information without having to?
We're seeing more requests from them.
Right.
And our standard fees they can't afford, but even the standard fees are not enough for $350. But we're getting more work from them.
Right.
How do we balance helping them get the extra fees to fulfill for them?
Well, it's a question that comes down to money, probably, for the legislature. They allot so much money for this process to go on, but they're, as we all can guess, there are a number of people who really can't get anything the way it's set up now, and it's a sad thing. But we brought it for the attention to the legislature in our meetings, and we hope we can get some kind of an exception carved out so that you know, there's we kind of all can't abide that, an unfairness in the process, and so we think that that has to be addressed, and we're trying to. But as I said, when it comes to the money, which is really what it's coming down to, that has to, the legislature has to approve it. So, yes, ma'am.
My question wouldn't really come under the jurisdiction of the board, probably in this direction, but my agency doesn't have the capacity to receive funds. So when we receive requests, we are charging, but we probably should be able to charge for those PIA requests. So do you have some sort of assistance that you could provide to my office so that if we have that situation, who monies could be allotted to?
I'm not sure, I think when we receive PIA requests in my office, we do not bill a fee where we can, but we don't have, because we don't have the capacity to receive money in my office, so because of that we take the expense on sending out the documents to the individuals who request it. So is there something that can be done to assist an agency such as mine who does not have the capacity to receive money, but we are always sending out documents in response to those requests?
Well, I, this is the first time I've heard of this. I've not encountered an agency with that problem yet. Do you not have capacity because of a logistical reason or because of some statutory limitation on your...
I don't think it's statutory. We just don't have people pay us money because of, I guess, the nature of what
we do.
So
you don't have any setup for it?
Exactly.
Well, I would think that you would want to consult your AAG about perhaps maybe entering into an interagency agreement for where perhaps another was affiliated agency could be designated perhaps to receive funds. I mean, I'm just thinking of that by analogy. Many very small nonprofits, for example, would enter into some kind of custodial agreement, partnership arrangement with a larger nonprofit to receive funds and run the kind of administrative functions you need around a bank account. And so if your office is not doesn't receive such funds regularly, so it's not worthwhile to have that infrastructure, I would look to what a partnering arrangement that you might set up a memorandum of understanding with another agency.
In the state?
Yes, within the state, I would assume. Beyond that, I would think you have to bite the bullet and set it up if you want to receive money.
Not necessarily. I just think that if it becomes really expensive for our agency, and I'm just thinking, I guess, long term,
right,
you know, on how much we're spending in order to send out these documents, because we get requests from inmates, you know, with what we do as well. So I'm just trying to figure out if there's something that can be done. But I appreciate it. I can look into it a little more.
Yeah, I mean, and if your concern is that is focused specifically on inmates, you may want to contact the Department of Public Safety and Corrections. They maintain specific accounts for inmate funds of different sorts, and so they have some experience managing limited funds that are used for inmate welfare purposes. So I would think perhaps one of the AAGs at the department or somebody within the department would be able to. The Public Affairs Office could probably steer you to the right person or the Assistant Attorney General's.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Are most of the cases that you look at about fees?
I would say yes.
Have you had any cases where it was about denial of records? And is there any movement, I guess in the second part of my question, is there any possibility of a movement toward being able to deny records to people who are looking for the records purely for a money-making ability on their end? Because I have a monthly PIA that goes out for attorneys who are just ambulance chasers, basically, for people who have been injured on the job.
Similarly, I get total of about five. My agency gets about 500 requests a calendar year, and I would say about 30% of them are from commercial entities seeking public data in the procurement context, which is strictly for commercial purposes.
Isn't there an exception in the fee structure?
Darren?
At this point, the board only has jurisdiction to look at a fee dispute when a fee has been over $350. So they don't look at denial of documents or things like that. But in the current scheme of things under the PIA, starting with the principle that you don't technically want to ask someone what they're requesting documents for. If it is for a commercial purpose, it wouldn't be in the public interest for you to give them a break on fees. So your tool at that point would be to charge them the actual costs to your agency of producing the records. But there's not a blanket exemption for your responsibilities to respond simply because you know someone's using the documents for a commercial purpose.
That was more on the recommendations.
Yeah.
We have that exemption with regard to student directory information,
right,
when sought for a commercial.
Right. And I think that's the only place in the PIA that specifically says...
I lobbied for that in 2008 because we were essentially giving away, because it would be under 2 hours, mailing lists of our students' email addresses, home addresses, parents' addresses to credit card companies, furniture rentals, apartment complexes. And within the procurement context, I'm trying to make the parallel to put the idea in the minds of people who are on the forefront, because I'm not, that it is becoming abusive. Similarly, when I think about abuse, if a third of the requests you receive are from a single filer, those become problematic and clog the system. The statute and the manual do not currently allow for action. Or they don't give advice on, well, what do you do if the filing is for abuse and harassment purposes. It's double talk because the manual says, well, you have not replied, it's abusive or harassing, but nobody should file a request if it's abusive or harassing.
And I think right. I think the manual mentions at this point, if those sort of abusive requests come in with within a close period of time, we aggregate them for purposes of the two free hours. But I mean, otherwise, it may be an issue, at least under the current scheme of things, where the ombudsman could potentially provide some assistance, perhaps.
Yeah, I try. I try. what Laura's saying is the experience I've had is that the percentage of requesters who fall in that category are small, but the amount of time that they take up, both agency staff time and my office's time for that matter, is out of proportion to their numbers. And so it really is a challenge to work with those requesters and to try to guide them towards some more reasonable limit. We have some success in some cases and little in others, to be honest with you. I have talked to the folks who work in the FOIA Ombudsman office, and they don't have any silver bullets either. I mean, they're dealing with requests on such a massive scale. I mean, they have millions of these every year. And, they go through the same things you all are going through on a larger scale, and they basically have told me that they just simply try to cut it off when they have concluded that this is all I can do for the person. We fulfilled our obligation the best we can, and you just say, thank you very much. nothing further I can do here. And then they may come back again, and you can't stop that from happening under the current law. But at least you can terminate a particular matter when you feel, it's abusing, your office staff or your resources.
Well, and it abuses our constituents as well, because in my case it's injured workers, So through no fault of their own, if they're going to receive benefits, they must file a claim with the commission. And their personal information is in our database, and we get a request every month for all the claims that were filed in that month. And the only thing we can withhold is public employees. And they do that to mail letters. Mm-hmm. And there are about 30 attorneys across the state that request this list. And they mail letters en masse to all these claimants. And then we get called saying, how dare you give out our public information, our personal information. I don't have any control over that. I advise that we go to the legislators.
I'm surprised that's not protected by HIPAA or the Privacy Act.
I can't give medical information, but that doesn't include their address and the insurance company and who their employer was and when their accident happened.
So you, how many of these requests do you get a month?
About 30.
From the same group of attorneys?
And then we have another one that wants a list of all the first reports of injury. Well, we get about 15,000 of those a month. And then there's the subrogation groups that want that list over a year period because they represent Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, Travelers.
What type of fee do you charge them, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, it's all electronic. They don't want it on paper, so mm-hmm. It's all electronic. We did put in $100 an hour for redaction. But, you know, at this point, the redaction now is under 2 hours because it's the same report. But it doesn't change the fact that the people who have simply been hurt doing their job and are now receiving benefits that they're entitled to have to have their name put out there and made public to a group of people who just want to solicit information.
Why not file something in the court? I mean, there is that catch all that if it depends upon the interest, you can seek protection in the court. And I think between the same request, but whenever I would at least try, file something, maybe get some standing order, and just deal with the cooperation you can get from the court. Because I think, we're all, I think, kind of shocked with that type of information that we're just something that's accessible for people for that purpose. I mean, it could
help you out now until the law. I'll discuss that with my AG. He did not seem to feel that was enough.
But the individuals that are affected, they could file something potentially as well.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. But she said that individuals are calling her and complaining about the information, so that's another recommendation that she could potentially make to those individuals.
Right, but they're not going to afford. It's not really the time or energy or the cost to them.
That's true.
Well, the legislature might, I'm glad you brought this up, because the legislature might see this as something that should be carved out of the act. I think they hear what's really going on, they may want to do something about that.
I'd like to hear from the board or even from my colleagues who are maybe similarly situated, your thoughts on the trend toward email-oriented requests for 10 years worth of emails between 20 or 30 different individuals where the data has to be captured as a kind of big dump and then reviewed. I can send out an estimate because I call them all estimates when I give somebody a pricing that can range from $10,000 to
$150,000.
Right. And I'm not at $100 an hour yet for redaction. Everything has to be read over, mm-hmm. talking emails
right.
before they're released, whether it's student record information, ongoing research, confidential, commercial, or financial information, and
individual, records regarding the finances of an individual, social numbers, dates of birth, all of that. Are people seeing this uptick?
We've had these kind of cases, and if there's an estimate, it's a large estimate. We don't hear the complaint if it's just an estimate. So if it's that, we refer it over to the ombudsperson, and they try to get the parties together to work out something that would be reasonable. Obviously, somebody doesn't want to pay $150,000 to get this information, but again, you don't want to have to do all the work either.
We don't initiate the work until
Yeah, I understand, but yeah. But even in just getting an estimate, you have to put some effort.
It takes a significant amount of time just to get to that point. In my letters, it sounds as if this is a system you deem legitimate enough. When I do work up an estimate, I let the person know to the penny how much I think it will cost, that we will, as we get into it, we will know more information and offer a refund or an additional invoice as appropriate. Because sometimes you don't know what you're looking at. I mean, I've read through 5 to 10 banker's boxes of documents to review, and people sometimes do pay, but they're easily over $350. So that, thus my question of how, where that came from, because when the amendments were put out in 2015, my state agency found about all of it after they were passed. We would have weighed in really differently. The bulk of what people are interested in from us tend to be heavy email oriented. They want to know why our faculty think climate change is real. So they want to get at very particular topics for no less than 3 years. 21 years is my longest, and that's just this calendar. Sadly, we have some of this stuff. That's the problem.
So is your concern that because so many of your requests, particularly these email ones, would be well over the $350 threshold, that means that too many cases could potentially be open to being brought to us, and the burden that you have to do to reply to our requests would be inflated because the threshold for $350 is so low?
$350 from the start was a very low number. I do $350 just to be done with it, and don't even charge the person, even if it's over $200, because I just don't want to be kind of bothered. But when something's in the 5 and 6 figures easily, as a larger and larger proportion of requests are, whether they be from media or think tanks, get a lot of PACs and think tanks who have a position, and they want to know, about honeybees and pesticides used on honeybees. So they're targeting very specific faculty online. It's all the time. I'm up to 317 for the calendar year.
But that $350 threshold doesn't really affect how you respond unless that case comes before this board, is that correct?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it would still happen. It doesn't stop them from filing. But I think I would have such a large proportion of that bill come to you. And I can account for every penny in the estimate I get, and what I give is an estimate. So I guess technically none of my invoices, I don't necessarily send an invoice, I send an estimate. So I guess that always keeps me safe, and I guess out of your reach.
Right.
I will
continue doing that.
Well,
the majority of the board's opinions so far have actually opined on the reasonableness of estimates. So, but if you've already put together the detailed calculus for the estimate, then you already have the response ready to go. As well.
And I don't typically share that. I pull the actual hourly rates. If there's a team of 15 people, I pull the actual hourly rates, straight time, no overhead, because that was an opinion. but I never did. And 2 hours to back out. I take the 2 hours from the person with the highest hourly rate because I like to be able to say that as a courtesy. Typically, the first 2 hours tends to be an individual with a lower hourly rate. Mm-hmm. So it's a little disingenuous if I'm sending you a bill for $60,000. I'll at least take 2 hours off from an individual with a higher hourly rate and send them the bill and let me know what they want to do.
If it's a commercial enterprise that's looking for that information, would she still have to back that 2 hours out, or could she charge for those 2 hours?
I still have to back the 2 hours
same
out
thing.
Yeah, I'm putting bugs in your ears because you all have legislatures more than I do. Because for us, this is really real. It's an important statute. I've been at the university for over 20 years in this capacity. But I believe in the concept of transparency, but I feel that there's so many people that are abusing it, not what the statute was intended. And you all began to see that from day one of your creation, by the nature of particularly the employment-related inquiries you get and the ones that just recur. Another bug, when people send PIAs as quasi-discovery, when we know that they are trying to position themselves that way. It's difficult to fight things on several fronts. When you're at the table.
We have students that send PIAs for their journalism class, just to get the information. Not because they're really going to use it, not because it has any bearing on what they're going to do 3 months down the road and they finish that class. Mm-hmm. And I'll get, you know, that entire class, 30 people will send me the same PIA. Different pieces of information.
One trick I've done with that, I started about 10 years ago, I suspect it's a journalism student, I call them up and say, do you just need the fact of the filing to get credit? Sometimes teachers say, file a public records request for extra credit. Prove to me that you filed mm-hmm. the request. Because they're not interested in the data. And they said, oh yeah, I'm just filing it. And I'll say, I'll send you an email that says, this is to confirm that you have filed mm-hmm. a public records request. And then they let me close it out. We have a journalism, and I've reached out to some of the teachers. And you can say, I'd rather come and speak to them about the PIA than have them plug for such. So that got me down to about 500 accounts.
There's one student that I have got an A because he aggravated me for months.
You deserve that A, bud.
Yes, ma'am.
Christopher Siofi, I can't remember the name.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow.
Yeah, I did.
There's an exemption that may be able to use.
There's an exemption in 4.3.15, with general provisions that allows a custodian to deny inspection of a traffic accident, criminal charging document, traffic citation, if it looks to be filed by an attorney for purposes of soliciting business.
I think it was interpreted by our AG that was only for the CMB.
It's a pretty limited scope of what records that cover. Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, the ombudsman hasn't had any matters with that one. So I think reinforces that it's pretty narrow which agencies use.
Yes, sir.
Say I have a convicted child molester who's, you know, he molested numerous kids in my jurisdiction, and every year he just out of, you know, he PIAs the victim's family, his brothers, his sisters, just to annoy us. So I obviously deny his indigency request every year, and that it takes him a couple of months to make a license plate to come up with money, but he always does, and I have to redact him. But before we go waiving all these fees, inmates, just keep in mind that you have, you're dealing with these people too.
Yeah, that's not iron. We are, I think everybody understands that's the other side of the coin. And so what do you give him? I mean, with you redact out the names, addresses.
So much, you can hardly see what's in it. And I deny his indigency request, but it's just annoying that it's obvious what he's doing. College victims are becoming 18 now.
So he's the requests are regarding
the victims,
the names of the people on his who are witnesses related to his own case, and
not necessarily witnesses, just probably victims we didn't charge him with, but he just likes to keep up with all his victims, their family members. And
oh, so you're I'm just confused. Like, why would you have the records on those people?
No, I mean a lot of the victims in this particular case still come from dysfunctional families, so occasionally they get picked up for shoplifting, and he just wants to see what's going on with his peeps, and it's just sort of annoying that it's not just the victims, he wants to know their brothers and sisters, and like I said, it's, and he's doing like 40 years, so he's not getting out anytime soon, it's just a little bit annoying.
But he's got a lot of time.
I might recommend that you speak with whoever your attorney is to look into the investigations exemption in 4351. It's even if it's closed,
we looked at that. I just thought because the case is over 5 years old,
you still would have discretion even with closed investigations. Anyway, something to possibly throw around again with your attorney.
And to the gentleman's. To the gentleman's point, I think as a board, if we were going to make any exemptions for incarcerated folks, they would only be for records pertaining to their own case. Mm-hmm. And but we should make a point to clarify that in anything we document. So thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the reasonableness of fees. So when we're calculating annual salary of someone divided down to an hourly wage, and they say, you know, this person 2 hours, this person 3 hours. But there has been some discussion about being using a weighted salary, which would include the actual cost to the department, you know, with insurance, health benefits, and things like that. Have you dealt with that? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, the statute relates to the earnings of the person that the wages, not the mm-hmm. cost of that you're paying the other 20% that we know is out there for.
So it has to be.
Yeah, that's the statute.
Well, I agree with that when we're talking about personnel time. But what if, for example, somebody asks for video? The statute allows you to charge with actual costs associated with processing the request. And if you burn the CD, and it's, you know, 15 CDs of video footage, that isn't, the cost of the CDs is an actual cost outside of the personnel charges to locate, gather, edit, and burn the CD. And I'm thinking of our police department. We don't use just regular, they're evidently not regular old CDs like Staples. They're like gold. They're special CDs because they are used in court, and there's something magic about them, I don't know, but they cost a little more than that. Or if there were photocopying, for example, a per page cost, there's the human time, but there could be copying charges, and in the day of, you know, paper as much. But there could be discs, for example. I think that those could be rolled into a total cost. Am I incorrect in that?
Well, what have we...
It's not just personnel.
We've done the personnel, but also aren't there reasonable costs for expenses, things like CDs that get tacked on to it?
If I'm reading correctly, I'm looking at the manual and the citation here. It says there's a fee bearing a reasonable relationship to the recovery of actual costs incurred by the government unit. So the same language that we would use about
not over
per hour for outage, right?
But
the PIA manual does seem to say that a reasonable fee for copies is permissible.
Yeah. By extension.
Mm-hmm. It's just one more way in which as long as the fee bears a reasonable relationship to your costs.
Yeah, and that's how reasonable fee is defined in the statute itself. Yeah. It's recovery of actual costs incurred by your agency. That's right. Material costs, it's personnel costs. It's just not the fringe.
Right. Now, you may be referring, we did put out an opinion where we were... there was an agency that was charging for not just the wages of the person, but also the additional overhead of benefits and
17% or whatever. Sure. On top of their straight time hours.
Right. And we found the language in the statute that deviated from this reasonable overall fee, where it specifically talked about personnel and their pay wages. So that's kind of where that separation came from, but I don't think we would have interpreted that as also reducing your ability to charge for the media.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
I have a quick question about an FPIA that transformed the role of person in interest. In Montgomery County, we've received several FPIAs from the press for the Supreme Court nominee. They're not person in interest. We're denying them. We've just received an MPIA asking us if we received MPIAs on the Supreme Court person. So that changes the role of the person asking, the media or organization asking, can we give that up, or is that... Because it changed it to...
So somebody was asking, has filed a PIA, asking you for a list of all of the PIAs.
Yes.
Just the requests. Right. Not your responses.
Right.
Just the requests. But a list of things.
Right.
The manual says that the fact of the PIA could be public in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah, all requests that are made for the PIA are themselves public documents.
Yes, and it changed the role to an acceptable role that we would reduce to.
I think I misunderstood you at the first point about what was the first line request?
The first group of requests are about the Supreme Court nominee.
But what specifically, what records?
Any record you can find on the headline.
Address, person.
Okay.
So they're not in interest. But now you're being asked, how many MPIAs did you get for him?
Wow.
So do we respond to that by telling them we've received 4 or 5?
I mean, we can talk afterwards. Yeah, so I think we need some more information about what the first line inquiries were, but the list of PIA requests and the requests themselves that come in are public records.
What are the responses? I heard you draw that out as something different. The responses to those PIAs, I thought, would also be public records.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we drew that out as a difference. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't misreading.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. And you send them out. So what they do is they get to look and see whether you're charging the same amounts, whether you're doing something special for someone else.
And they're just trying to piggyback off of somebody else's work so that they don't have to, like, reinvent the wheel.
But that's going to take me more than 2 hours.
So is it beneath it who's never getting the actual request is being your address, email, or is that public?
Yeah, that's again, talk to your attorney, but I would think that's also public information. If you're submitting a request, you have to assume that you're going to then be a public.
And on our website, for folks who submit requests to us, I believe we put that warning on there to notify them that their request would be disavowed.
As soon as they file a complaint, they could also be subject to PI requests to the board.
So whatever mechanism you all have in place to receive requests, it might behoove you to notify your requesters that their requests would also be publicly disclosable.
A lot of media outlets will ask to send you a PIA for your PIAs. They don't even necessarily want your responses and the documents you may have released pursuant to those PIAs. They like to know who has asked for what, particularly if say Bloomberg asked for it first and they had to pay. This way, if they're second or later, they know that the information is already gathered and out there and available so that they can just make a follow-up inquiry. Now, sometimes it's years later, and I mean, I don't necessarily keep everything from 2014. I release something, right, and you ask for me in 2018. But for media, that often is because the first person who asked for it, they pay, right? It's the subsequent people who are looking to get it for free because they know the work has already been done. And sometimes it's recognizance just to see who's asking for what.
This is a slight tangent, but I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
People do know about that because one of my requesters is publicrequester@gmail.com. I went after him and said, you know, I need to have your name. That's in our policy. No, that's not required.
So this is...
So I have no way of knowing who they are, and they know that.
I don't know how realistic this is to even ask. I don't know how... But on the federal level, a lot of agencies create a website where they have a repository of previous responses to requests under FOIA. Would it be helpful, are you all as custodians finding that you're getting a lot of repeat requests, people asking for the same thing that you've already requested before? Would it save you work if there were the state of Maryland had a repository where those things could have already been posted, so you're not getting these, you know, if it's already been redacted and it's already been cleared for release? Would it be helpful to you all as custodians to just not be getting, are you getting requests for the same thing over and over from multiple people where that might be helpful?
I can say yes, but what they're asking for is information that our constituents have already said they don't want it out there. So that's why we hesitate to do that.
Fair enough.
In Montgomery County, the government does that. But one of the requests was for all the email addresses of people and the emails of the council members. And they fulfilled that request, and then they put it on their website. And people say, mm-hmm.
Losing bidder wants to see all of the proposals of everyone else who bid on a very specific procurement. The only other universe of people interested in those particular records are going to be anyone else that bid on that procurement. So the utility for the procurement related and the email related, which are the time intensive and very expensive inquiries, such a centralized concept of frequently asked for documents wouldn't be as helpful, but I could see it for the routine employment contract, similar to what the Baltimore Sun does with state government salary information and the searchable database that our own campus paper has duplicated for our employees. That's great if they just want the salary.
Okay.
And sometimes tell people go to the Baltimore Center.
And I have seen some federal agencies do it that way, where it's just the frequent, the ones that they know they're going to get frequently, they just put it up there and save themselves some time.
Also, as a matter of course, we can't.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
As a matter of course, Montgomery County Public Schools has added to its process for RFPs. Any bidder will propose a redacted version of whatever there are. So it's a matter of a process and say, this can be subject to public disclosure. So redact it already. Yes. So they have the redacted copy, and it's always there. And we're starting to do it in the contract as well, because we're getting the
I do it on the back end. You're doing it.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming. You know, the discussion that we've had, it shows the, you know, the overall intent of all this was to open up everything. But when we open up everything, it gets problems, and you know, you get the police officer here who's trying to protect his local people from, you get people that are obviously taking advantage, the attorneys that are, you know, grabbing just the names and address of everybody so they can generate some business through all that. And yes, ma'am, go ahead. I 100% agree. Thank you. Thank you for recognizing that.
And she's not in the law, but let's put her in the law.
Thank you very much for coming. I think we're going to adjourn at this point.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.